5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running.
There is no other institution that has the ability uniquely.
Without a heritage, every generation starts over.
Ask not.
To remind the current regime.
What your country.
We the people tell the government what it is allowed to do.
To get back in their box and stay there.
Liftoff.
From the Heritage Foundation, this is Heritage Explains.
Historically, Americans have been very proud of their military. And rightly so. Men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces have saved humanity as we know it, from existential threats throughout history. But that doesn't mean that everything has always gone right with the U.S. military. Decisions about what capabilities to pursue, what strategies to employ, and where to place resources are all complex. One slightly humorous example is Project X-Ray, which was undertaken by the U.S. Army Air Forces and the U.S. Navy during the Second World War. In this weapons research program, small quantities of napalm with timer fuses were attached to Mexican free-tailed bats, who were then deployed in a disintegrating container from a bomber aircraft. The idea was that when these bats were deployed over a Japanese city, they would roost unobserved in the largely paper and wood structures of Japanese buildings. The so-called bat bomb underwent extensive testing, but there were major setbacks, including an incident in which armed bats were accidentally released, leading to a major fire at Carlsbad Army Airfield Auxiliary Air Base in New Mexico. Ultimately, Project X-Ray was canceled as the war dragged on and military leaders looked to a swifter end to the conflict in the form of the atomic bomb. But proponents of Project X-Ray believe that their innovation could have brought about a decisive end to the war without the devastation of a nuclear weapon. The story of Project X-Ray demonstrates the difficulty of military engagement, both yesterday and today, as we face a world that is contentious and technologically ever-changing. This year, the Biden administration put out their defense budget for fiscal year 2025. Here at the Heritage Foundation, we had some concerns about that budget and countered with a report of our own. Here to explain that report are three experts from the Allison Center for National Defense here at the Heritage Foundation: Wilson Beaver, Alex Velez-Green, and Bob Peters. All right. On Heritage Explains today, we are joined by a small crowd. It's a little bit of a new thing for us on Heritage Explains. We have three of our experts from the Allison Center for the National Security here with us this morning. We're going to do a little bit of a roundtable here. You can introduce yourself, tell our audience basically what you do here at Heritage. So we'll start to my right with Wilson Beaver.
Good morning. I'm Wilson Beaver, the policy advisor for the defense budget here in the Allison Center for National Security.
And sitting next to him is Mr. Alex Velez-Green.
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm a senior policy advisor in the Allison Center. I focus on defense strategy, alliance management, and then just prior to this, I was working for Senator Josh Hawley over on the Armed Services Committee in the Senate.
And finally, we're rounding out this morning with Mr. Bob Peters.
Hi, I'm Bob. I'm the nuke and missile defense guy here at Heritage.
Well, we've brought everybody together today here because in March, the Biden administration put out their fiscal year 2025 defense budget, and the Allison Center here at Heritage responded by putting out our own conservative defense budget for fiscal year 2025, which we maintain is a marked improvement on Biden's budget. So we're going to start off with Wilson. As you all looked at this budget that came out in March from the Biden administration, what did you find was lacking in it, and how did you decide to respond with your own budget?
I would say the number one thing that we identify as a problem with Biden's defense budget is that it fails to have defense spending flow from defense strategy. They have a strategy. They tell us that they're going to focus on the Indo-Pacific and that we are now in a near-peer competition with China. And yet, they don't spend like any of that is true. If you look at their budget, it is actually a decrease in the size of surface warships for the Navy, for example. It has politicized spending on things like climate change. It basically just keeps doing what we've been doing for decades, with very few shifts in a meaningful direction towards what it means to have a strategic competitor like China that is, you know, almost, it has an economy 70% that of the United States, right? So this is not like dealing with things we've dealt with in the recent past, Iraq, Afghanistan. This is dealing with a great power that can challenge us and potentially usurp the American-led world order. So you would think that that's a challenge that causes for a significant shift in spending strategy, right? But basically nothing has changed. It's the same sort of stuff you've seen for decades. To highlight this, they haven't increased spending for almost any munitions. We've been talking about munitions shortages for the past several years. It's in the news all the time because of Ukraine. And yet only one key munition, the LRASM, got a very, very small plus up. I think it was like 11 or 15 more over last year. So basically we say that we need to be shifting money into the procurement of the ships, planes, and munitions that the United States military needs to effectively deter China. And we come back to that over and over, ships, planes, munitions. We want to build more ships. We want to keep ships that still have life in them. The Navy's actually asking to retire a whole bunch of ships that don't need to be retired yet, which if you think that China is a near-term threat, is absurd. And we ask for very significant plus-ups in munitions. We think that putting these orders in now, asking for really like substantially larger amounts of munitions is the only way to send a signal to industry that this is something that we're going to be buying for them from a while and they need to invest in capacity and start building this stuff now, hiring people so that long term we can fix these problems.
So from the top line, you just mentioned one of the main points of the conservative defense budget, which is to allocate money towards actual stuff that we would use to fight a war, procurement, versus RDT&E, which is research, defense, testing, and evaluation.
Basically R&D.
I thought it was R&D, yeah. But it's probably there's a whole lot more that goes into that.
The military in general always adds acronyms, you know, they get longer each year.
So I guess I have two questions that come out of that. The first one is, what are some of the other kind of key parts of this budget? And then I have a follow-up on that RDTE thing, but I guess I'll ask that first. So what are the other kind of main portions of the conservative defense budget?
Sure. We at Heritage understand that we're operating in a fiscally constrained environment. We believe that the national debt is a real problem. So even though we're asking for a small increase in total spending to match inflation, and we'll come back to that later, but we're also asking for major internal reallocations within the Department of Defense to make it spend more efficiently. So we're asking for around $40 billion to be moved out of operations and maintenance and R&D accounts into procurement. So less money on long-term R&D, which sometimes amount to science projects that will never actually deliver a program. And even if they do deliver a program, it won't be ready till like 2040. So if there's a real threat from China now, we really can't be spending that money. Instead, it needs to be going into weapons that already exist and operations and maintenance. So this is, you know, the day-to-day functions of the military, but it's not just the services. There is also a massive amount going to bloated bureaucracies at a lot of these agencies. There's a really long list of them, and some of them shouldn't exist at all. But basically, we're advocating for cutting their operating accounts and moving it into buying equipment for the Navy and the Air Force.
And then one of the other pieces that's included in here is a 3% increase in the overall military budget across the board. And Biden suggested a 1% increase in his budget. So for us, you mentioned as conservatives, we're always looking for that fiscal responsibility piece, but we're actually asking for more money for the military budget than the Biden administration is. So can you give us kind of an explanation of that?
Well, the main reason we came up with that number is to at least match inflation for the last year. It's actually not going to be enough. During the course of the Biden administration, inflation has been above 5% several years in a row. Now it's something like 3 or 4. We want to at least match inflation because if you don't, there will be a net decrease in buying power for the Department of Defense. They will struggle to maintain their current programs. So at the very least, when the administration is causing this inflation, to make sure that the military doesn't decrease in capabilities, we need to increase spending to match inflation.
So, Alex, moving on to you, Wilson mentioned earlier that we want to make sure that defense spending flows out of defense strategy. So what was going on strategically that informed the creation of this budget? You know, what sort of military strategy are we considering?
Absolutely. I fully support everything that Wilson said on this, and it was a real privilege to be a part of this effort. Wilson, frankly, led a huge portion of. And to your point, I think a lot of this does start with strategy. It starts with a clear-eyed look at the world and evaluation of what is it we're trying to accomplish, what are the resources available with which to try and accomplish that, and then, you know, how do you align those goals with those means available. I think we can be frank. The world is a dangerous place and it's only getting worse. You know, we see that Europe is at war, the Middle East is at war, the Indo-Pacific unfortunately looks like it may not be far behind. Our border is overrun. There are new threats to the homeland developing, and there's a lot to be done But at the same time, we are in a fiscally constrained environment. The U.S. military does face meaningful constraints. Wilson talked about many of them. We don't have all the ships that we need. We don't have all the submarines that we need. Many of the submarines we have are in maintenance for long term, and they just haven't been able to get off those dry docks. We don't have the munitions we need, right? And this is all just to perhaps fight a single war against a major power threat, no less multiple wars at once. So these are the problems we're facing. And the question becomes, okay, well, what do you do? Dr. Kevin Roberts, president here at Heritage, whom we have the privilege of serving under, you know, he has been very clear. Given the dangers we face and the limited resources at our disposal, the United States needs to prioritize rigorously, thinking first and foremost about, you know, what does our nation need to secure our security, our freedom, and our prosperity? And then how can we, at the same time as we prioritize, work more closely to empower our allies and partners to strengthen those alliances around the world so that our allies and partners are also stepping up and doing their part, and we can collectively, again, protect not just American security, freedom, and prosperity, also those of our allies and our partners. This is the strategic context. And I would say, as reflected in the report, you do see that shift of resources, dedicated focus in a very focused way, exactly as Wilson was describing, as Bob will speak to, on the capabilities required for the United States to be ready for a conflict with China. And I'll sort of caveat very importantly here that we are moving fast and at scale, or at least trying to and recommending that we do so, not because anyone in this room or this institution wants to fight a war with China. Quite the opposite. It's sort of the longstanding adage, right? You know, if you want peace, prepare for war in large measure so that you can deter it. So you can make sure that Beijing wakes up every single day. I'm quoting the commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific, but it's a good quote, right? So make sure that Xi Jinping wakes up every day and thinks to himself, today is not the day. I will not be able to accomplish my goals. Therefore, I'm not going to try. That is the goal. That's what this is all about. And I'll say, you know, one thing that really stood out, I think, about this report is that it acknowledged the hard choices that go with that, right? Not just in terms of, you know, shifting funds from RDT&E to procurement, for instance, but also thinking about how we manage U.S. forces around the world. I mean, one of the things this report was very clear about, which is if we are going to be able to deter China, we've got to focus a larger share of the joint forces resources on the Indo-Pacific. So we are in place. So Beijing wakes, so Xi Jinping wakes up every day, looks at the map and says he cannot do it, right? But if we're going to focus those forces there, given the fact that the joint force is under such constraints, means we have to make meaningful reallocations across theaters. So for example, you know, the report is very clear, you know, in the Middle East, we're going to empower Israel, we're going to strongly support Israel's defense, support integration between Israel and our Gulf partners in order to enable them to step up and do more to defend our collective interests while the United States, you know, continue to provide key support, but again, freeing up resources. Similar in Europe, right? We're very clear. If we are going to be able to deter Europe, we're going to have to reallocate significant forces from the European theater to do that. Now, you know, the risk there is then you create gaps in conventional deterrence in the European theater, which could invite Russian aggression against NATO. We don't want that, which is why we argue for Europeans, for our allies to take primary responsibility for Europe's conventional defense, relying still on the United States for our extended nuclear deterrent, which Bob will speak about, as well as certain other forces we can provide that do not detract from our ability to deter China or defend the U.S. homeland. And then we say in very specific terms, you know, we should, this is a significant, you know, shift in resources and allocations within Europe, but it's vital not just for the United States, but also for NATO's future. And we should seek to get there as quickly as possible, working collaboratively with our allies. And I thought that that's absolutely essential. And I think, you know, it's another example of a way in which this report is acknowledging realities and dealing with them, I think, in a very forthright way.
Okay, heading over to you, Bob. One of the things that Alex mentioned was hard choices. And one of those hard choices is nuclear weaponry. And fortunately, that is your area of expertise. And actually, our next interview for Heritage Explains is you talking all about nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence. But for our conversation today, one of the things that is heavily featured in this new defense budget, rather this featured in the conservative defense budget, is nuclear weaponry. Can you talk about how nuclear weapons factor in?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And as Alex and Wilson spoke to, the goal is to deter a war. And the way you do that is fielding a military that is credible. And to be credible, you've got to have the capabilities to actually deter the adversary and make him think, as Alex said, today is not the day. So you need a strong, robust conventional force, which gets to, you know, why Wilson talked so much about the need to build more ships and more planes and restock our munitions so that we've got those conventional capabilities that will make our adversaries think, oh man, I do not want to fight these guys. I do not want to fight the American-led coalition, whether it's in Europe or Asia. But the other component of that is the nuclear arsenal, right, which is the ultimate backstop of American security, but also for allied security. And, you know, we have extended deterrence commitments to our allies in Japan and South Korea, but then also in NATO, of course. And what that means is we're willing to use nuclear weapons to deter strategic attack on those states, and we will make sure that those states do not fall to either China or Russia. Now, the problem that we have is that the American arsenal is very old. The newest warhead in our stockpile is 35 years old at this point. The newest one was built in 1989. Some of them were built as late as the Johnson administration. And the missiles that are meant to carry them, they were designed in the 60s and 70s. Our ICBMs were supposed to retire in 1980. Our cruise missiles that are air-launched that have nuclear warheads on them were supposed to retire in 1988. They're still in service because, frankly, at the end of the Cold War, we simply decided not to replace them. So you've got very old warheads and very old missiles that are designed to deliver those warheads to target in a period when, you know, frankly, you know, wiring degrades over time. And moreover, air defenses improve. And so the United States has embarked upon a nuclear modernization process to basically put new warheads and new ballistic missiles in place. The problem at the same time, though, is that Russia has 10 times the amount of non-strategic nuclear weapons as the United States, and they're all facing Europe. In China, in the Pacific, it's even worse. We have no theater nuclear weapons in the region, and China is the fastest growing nuclear power on the planet. They're building 100 new warheads per year. And again, we have yet to build a new warhead despite being on year 14 of the nuclear modernization program that began in 2010. So it's not that any of us on the team wants to spark a new arms race, far from it. And none of us want to fight a nuclear war. That's the last thing we want to do. But the goal is to create a credible deterrent, and that requires a somewhat larger and more capable strategic arsenal. Those are the big missiles that can go to any spot on the planet. But perhaps more importantly, you actually need to rebuild the non-strategic arsenal. These are the relatively low-yield weapons on theater range, gravity bombs, and cruise missiles that are on the front lines that really are meant to deter a theater nuclear war. And for those systems, we've basically got rid of all those at the end of the Cold War. So that's why the conservative defense budget really says, folks, it's time we have to get serious about reconstituting this capability.
So one more element of this that I want to talk about is a section of the report about politicization of the DOD. And we've seen a lot of issues with that recently about staffing, about the administration trying to push a lot of things that are not really defense related within the defense budget. What does this report have to say about that?
In short, that the American military is not a social laboratory, and it needs to be focused on lethality and capability. That every time a senator wants some program for his home state, he shouldn't be sticking it in the defense budget. And when left-wing politicians want to try out their latest horrible idea, they should not be doing it to the Department of Defense. That's what we say. Some of this is fiscal. We would cut and save money by eliminating, for example, climate change initiatives, DEI employees. But the bigger thing is it doesn't really cost any money. It's just reforms that need to be made from the top down. Banning these sort of hyper-politicized left-wing initiatives like DEI, making all physical fitness tests gender neutral, striving to be apolitical. It's really hurt the image of the U.S. military to have senior officers opining on culture war topics in public. They shouldn't be doing that.
Can I add on one thing to that? There's a lot of stuff that's kind of seeped into the actual defense budget over a number of years that has nothing to do with defense. And so the conservative defense budget tries to excise that. And one of the examples we use is cancer research. The Department of Defense spends billions of dollars every year on research on how to fight cancer. And we're not pro-cancer here. Like, we think it's good that, you know, the government at some level funds research into how to fight cancer.
Although the other side does say we're pro-cancer.
I know that. But, you know, the cancer research should be done by the National Institutes of Health. That is their mission. That's not the DOD's mission. The problem is that things like that, the U.S. government has gotten into the habit of, well, the DOD's got all this money. We'll have them do the cancer research because they've got the huge budget. And so what we try to do is say, cancer research, things like that, that should go to Health and Human Services, National Institute of Health. We're going to use that money and try to put it into lethality, trying to make sure you've got a military that's capable of achieving the missions that the political leadership assigned to it.
Are there any final thoughts that you would, you know, have for people as they look through this document, as they're worried about the position of America on the world stage? You know, what would you advise them to be thinking about?
I would sum up this special report and the conservative defense budget with ships, planes, munitions. We need to be buying equipment. You'll hear all these reasons that everything else is important, but we need to be prioritizing. Some things are more important, and the most important thing right now is the equipment, the weapons systems that our military needs to deter China in the Indo-Pacific.
What I'd say is that if you imagine that there is a threat board somewhere, and you looked at Asia, Europe, Middle East, Red Sea, and you had the choice between, you know, green is everything good, yellow, things are looking a little dicey, red light bulb is things are bad. If I were to look at that board, it would be red light bulbs going off across the board. And the Biden budget reduces the size of the military, reduces the numbers of ships, it reduces the numbers of sailors, increases the number of civilians, and it, for all intents and purposes, it's a defense cut. And so that's why for us, as fiscal hawks who don't like the government spending money, we feel, guys, I mean, we're in a crisis. It's going to take multiple years to rebuild the military, rebuild ships, which take a long time to do, and restock our munitions. And the Biden defense budget is simply not a serious budget that does not take the crisis that we are in today seriously. We provide an alternative.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Wilson Beaver, Alex Velez-Green, and Bob Peters for their contribution to today's episode. You can follow all of them on X. Just look for the links in the show notes. You can also find a conservative defense budget for fiscal year 2025 at heritage.org. And thanks, as always, to you for listening to Heritage Explains. If you have any thoughts or feedback for us, we look forward to hearing from you. You can reach out to heritageexplains@heritage.org. Take care, and we'll see you next week.
Heritage Explains is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. It's written and produced by Mark Garney, Lauren Evans, and John Popp.